A few years ago, I was invited to speak on a nationally syndicated radio talk show on President's Day. In the course of our conversation, in which he made the mistake, or the host made the mistake of asking me what I thought about Abraham Lincoln, he also asked me who I thought were the two greatest or the two best presidents in American history, apart from George Washington. Of course, he said George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. I suggested that John Tyler and Grover Cleveland were the best. He yelled out into the microphone, "You're kidding me! I never even heard of those two guys." We'll be right back after this commercial break to find out why Circa historian Bill Potter thinks the best presidents were, get this, John Tyler and Grover Cleveland. Every couple years, Siena University polls university professors from around the nation on who the greatest presidents of the United States were. And they poll historians, political scientists, and law professors. And they ask them, and they take a huge sampling. It's a couple thousand university professors. And they do this little poll. There are other groups that also poll for various other reasons. But the poll is, who is the greatest American president? Rate or rank the presidents in order. Their criteria include things like leadership qualities, crisis management, accomplishments, political skill, appointments, character, and integrity. Other polls add communication skills, ability to work with Congress, and transparency. Some polls even break down the polling participants into liberals and conservatives. How do you think it all comes out? Well, first let me note that in none of the polls is constitutional faithfulness a category. And typically, integrity and character are tacked on at the end qualities. It's the other things that they admire in presidents that give them their greatness. Number one is almost always Abraham Lincoln, among both conservatives and liberals. Number two is occasionally George Washington, but Franklin Roosevelt more often. And this is just in general the polls, kind of giving a conglomeration there. Number four is Woodrow Wilson, sometimes Thomas Jefferson, occasionally Theodore Roosevelt. John Tyler typically ranks in the bottom six or seven. He keeps company with George W. Bush, James Buchanan, Franklin Pierce, and Andrew Johnson. Grover Cleveland typically appears kind of in the middle, in the teens or early 20s. Interestingly, in recent years, U.S. Grant, who used to be at the bottom, has been gradually moving up, as has Eisenhower and Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson's been steadily moving downward. Eisenhower has moved up a little bit. And amazingly, Lyndon Johnson is often in the top 10. That one really escapes me. The pattern? Presidents who expanded welfare programs, survived corruption scandals, or increased the size and power of government, and especially ignored the Constitution or led America in a war, are favored. Now, the poll at Siena was last taken, I think, in 2010. And here were their rankings for 2010. Siena's probably the best poll of college professors who are really in the know, as you will be able to tell from the rankings. Number one, Franklin Roosevelt. Number two, Theodore Roosevelt. Number three, Abraham Lincoln. Number four, George Washington, and that's swell. Number five, Thomas Jefferson. Number six, James Madison. Number seven, James Monroe. Maybe they only interviewed professors from the University of Virginia. I don't know. But those three in a row. And then Woodrow Wilson, Harry Truman, and Dwight Eisenhower round out the top ten. Well, their presuppositions, as I said, do not include fidelity to the Constitution. And compromise is a big plus, as is imagination. Franklin Roosevelt is number one in so many areas. Centralization of federal power, using it in a dictatorial fashion. He is really the apex of progressivism in American thought. Well, I don't want to talk about any of them anymore. That's it. They're gone. I want to talk about John Tyler, who is known to historians as his accidency, because he was the first vice president to accede to the presidency upon the death of the president. That had not happened prior to him. He was a Whig in terms of his party, but I'll talk about that in a minute. And I want to talk about Stephen Grover Cleveland, otherwise known as Big Steve, but he went by the name Grover. Now, in order to understand men like John Tyler and Grover Cleveland, you have to know a little bit about their family and their background. So I want to tell you a little bit about John Tyler's father, John Tyler Sr. His dates, 1747 to 1813, John Tyler Sr. He was 18 years old when Patrick Henry gave his famous speech in the House of Burgesses. Patrick Henry was 29 at the time. John Tyler was 18. He became an ardent patriot on that day. His father said he'd be hung as a rebel. And John Tyler Sr. said, so be it. He formed an intimate friendship with Patrick Henry. One of Patrick Henry's very few close personal friends was John Tyler Sr. He studied law under Robert Carter, and he became a representative from Charles City County, Virginia, the only county in the United States that provided two presidents to the presidency over history, over time. We lived there for 14 years. Well, he married well at the age of 29, and he settled in a little place called Greenway in Charles City, and they had eight children, one of whom, of course, is going to be John Tyler, the president. He sided with Patrick Henry in opposition to ratification of the Constitution because there was no Bill of Rights. This is the heritage that John Tyler, the president, is going to receive from his father. He opposed the slave trade. He became judge of the Admiralty Courts and judge of the State Supreme Court and served 20 years in the General Court of Virginia. He was a strict constitutionalist. He named two of his daughters, just as an aside, after his two best friends, Maria Henry and Martha Jefferson. He was Thomas Jefferson's roommate at William and Mary, I might add. And he was popular as a judge because of his incorruptibility and integrity. This is the father of John Tyler, who will become president. This is the reputation that he had. And it's a reputation that he formed around his son. He raised his son to become the governor of Virginia. He raised his son to become a man of substance and public service. But he did so in building into him the integrity and the strength that he himself possessed as a man consistently interested in liberty, in honesty, in justice. Those are the things he was known for.
but he was also a warm-hearted man, and he was an incorruptible judge. He hated case lawyers. He wanted causes decided on appeals to principle and not by an appeal to former cases. And he wouldn't make out very well today. And he never countenanced appeals to international legal settlements or international law. You can see he was a man way out of our time.
But he was a man of fixed and undeviating integrity. And I'd like to tell you about
he was called Judge Tyler. I'd like to tell you about Judge Tyler's life because it's worth studying. But it's really his son that we want to look at.
He had three sons and five daughters. He reared 21 children over whom he was guardian over the course of his life. And John Jr. was the sixth child. He was his second son. And his dates are 1790 to 1862. And John Tyler Jr., who's going to become president of the United States, is going to be a man that is remembered mostly by scholars as a man of firsts. You know, the first vice president to become president upon the death of the president. He was the first president to be married in the White House. His wife died when he was president. He remarried. Maybe I'll have time to tell a little bit of that story.
He was a man of, well, many firsts, but we want to look at his character and what he actually did as president.
John Tyler Jr. graduated from William & Mary at the age of 17. We don't know much about his youth, but we do know that his father, Judge Tyler, used to sit under a tree in the front yard at Greenway and gather all of his children and all of his other dependents, because he was always raising other people's children too, whose parents had died, and the Tylers would take them in. But he would gather them all around him, but especially little John, and he would tell them stories about Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, and the founding fathers, of which, as I said, he was an 18-year-old young man when he heard Patrick Henry give that speech, and then served in the cause of independence. But he passed on to his children the lore and the tales of his family, and the characteristics of the men with whom he had to do. He talked about Patrick Henry. He talked about what Patrick Henry was like and his character and his love of farming and his love of liberty and his willingness to sacrifice everything. All these things Judge Tyler told his children in stories. So we know little about John Jr., but we know that his father did that for him. He made reference to it. We know nothing of his college life. We do know that he was a voracious reader, and that he loved the classics. He was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates at the age of 21. He married Letitia Christian on his 23rd birthday after 4 years of courtship. He wrote a sonnet. He wrote a sonnet to her and kissed her hand 3 weeks before they were married. And that's all the physical contact they had prior to their wedding. He built his own house and eventually bought his father's house and moved in there. He met Thomas Jefferson when his father was governor and lived in Richmond as a youth as well. And John Tyler is destined to father 17 children himself, as had Patrick Henry. So I guess the stories of Patrick Henry rubbed off in some ways. But he would also, as Patrick Henry did, had two wives. His first wife would die and he would remarry. But he ended up with a large family. In fact, the largest family of any president of the United States. His major platform or his major political views were what would be described today as states' rights. He loved the Bill of Rights, and the Constitution was his bellwether
of judgment as a politician.
He opposed the central bank
and supported denying rechartering of that bank because he saw it as unconstitutional economic policy
and influence in the economy of the nation. He did his legal studies under Edmund Randolph. He read law. He didn't go to law school. In the old days, the way you became a lawyer is you read law. You joined yourself to a law firm, and the lawyers would train you and give you things to read and write, and you would assist them in their cases. And that's called reading law. And I think that there are still two states where you can do that, but I don't hear of anybody doing it in modern times. But that's what he did. He was the captain of a militia company formed in Charles City County. He served in the House of Representatives in 1816 at the age of 26, joining Henry Clay, John C. Calhoun, and Daniel Webster. He was what they called a states' rights Republican, although there was no Republican Party. And he opposed the American system. Well, we talked about that earlier, Henry Clay's idea of high tariffs, protection of Northeastern factories, and building internal improvements using tax money. He was an ardent opponent of that. So he clashed with Andrew Jackson. He disagreed with Andrew Jackson's invading Florida illegally and that sort of thing. He dined with, as a young lawyer, he dined with President James Madison. He disliked Dolly's attempt at French cooking, however. He was a 100 percenter, as one biographer said, and 100 percenters never achieve greatness. Everything was black and white to him when it came to politics. Does the Constitution allow it? And if it doesn't, then I'm not going to support it. His speeches were sensible, logical, states' rights. He fought the Missouri Compromise in 1820 because he believed it was unconstitutional. He served as the governor of Virginia, and he gave the funeral oration for Thomas Jefferson. He was elected to the Senate of the United States by the House of Burgesses. So this was a man of great, great experience, political experience, before he comes to the White House. As a matter of fact, he is a man who was prepared for that by his father, self-consciously. And he is going to take his place in a very unusual way. The Whig Party that was surrounding Henry Clay had one major plank. There was one major belief behind the party that created it. That was a unified and universal hatred of Andrew Jackson. They called him King Andrew the First. He was known as a man to the Whigs that was a rascal from the backwoods, a troublemaker, a dictator. He was also called the dictator. He was called lots of things, all of them bad. And Tyler joined the Whig Party because he disagreed with Jackson's views on nullification. He disagreed. He actually agreed with him on the charter, failing to recharter the National Bank. He did agree with him on that. But he just saw Jackson as problematic. And most Virginians belonged to the Democratic Party, the party of Jackson. But Tyler left the party of Jackson and joined the Whigs because of his conflicts with the president. Well, in the election of 1840, the Whigs had their best chance of ever winning an election. And their natural candidate would have been Henry Clay. Henry Clay had lots of enemies. He had as many enemies as Andrew Jackson did. And he had skeletons in his closet. And he was not a man of sterling character. And so he couldn't quite win the presidency, but he could do the next best thing. Because he created the Whig Party and because he controlled it, he could put somebody up for president that he could control. Get a weak candidate
and market him like the Democrats market their candidates and get him elected and then control him. And you call the tune. And that's what Henry Clay sought to do. So they picked William Henry Harrison, who was a soldier who had defeated the Indians. And it wasn't even known if Harrison had ever even voted in an election. He was a fine man, but he was getting on in years. And he wasn't political. And Clay and the party asked if he would like to be president, and they would help him. And Harrison agreed, and Harrison ran for president. And they needed Virginia to win the election. And so they decided that the best-known politician, the Whig politician in Virginia, was John Tyler. And so he was on the ticket. And it's, as you are well aware, William Henry Harrison had defeated the Indians at Tippecanoe. And so their slogan became Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And you've probably heard that before. And they had some other slogans. And they acted like Democrats instead of the sort of aristocratic, wealthy planters that most of the Whigs were. And they won the election. There are a number of reasons why they won. And the disaffected Democrat John Tyler suddenly was Vice President of the United States, which in those days was an absolutely nothing job. Name a single Vice President from Thomas Jefferson till the day, and you'll only be able to probably come up with a small handful. And those are the ones that became President from the assassination of the President. Or some other reason like that. They're obscure people. And John Tyler was going to be one of those obscure, know-nothing, do-nothing vice presidents. Except that the president died just a couple months after his inaugural address, which was delivered much too long in as far as the people were concerned, and eventually he took ill, and he died. Well, John Tyler was living at the time in Williamsburg, which was no longer the capital city, but it was near his home in Charles City. He had a home in Williamsburg. And so one night, a rider came and said, "President Harrison has died. This is unprecedented. What do you do? What does the Constitution allow?" John Tyler assumed that the vice president then should become the president. Henry Clay sent a message to Tyler and said, "Stay right there. We'll call you when you're needed." And it's thought by historians that Henry Clay, who didn't particularly like John Tyler because he was a man of principle, he was a 100%er. And Clay knew that. Clay could manipulate and play Harrison like a puppet. But John Tyler is another person altogether, a problem for the Whig Party. He's a lifelong Democrat that became a Whig. And he carried Virginia for them in the election. But he doesn't have the convictions about the Constitution that Henry Clay does and the other big Whigs. And so they tell John Tyler to stay put. And they'll call him to Washington when he's needed. And historians think there was going to be a palace coup and somehow install either Henry Clay or one of his cohorts as president. Well, the second Tyler heard that the president was dead, he jumped on his horse and he galloped all the way to Washington, looking neither to the right hand nor to the left. And he woke up the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in his bed, put his hand on the Bible, was sworn in as the President of the United States. And now there's going to be trouble. For His Excellency is now President, and the American system and all of the Whig policies that he doesn't particularly care for, you know, he joined the party because he didn't like Andrew Jackson. It's going to be a big problem. Congress starts passing law after law, and John Tyler vetoes them, and they're passed by his own party. I mean, here's a Whig president with a Whig Congress finally getting to fulfill their agenda, much of which is unconstitutional, and John Tyler vetoes. And the Democrats are thrilled because they know right now John Tyler is going to be a one-term president because the Whigs now hate him, and he's their own party. The cabinet that Harrison had had, Tyler's going to need a new cabinet. Because Harrison's cabinet were all Whigs. They were all insiders. They were all Henry Clay's men. And so John Tyler picks his own cabinet, men of integrity, men of honor, men of experience, men that can be trusted. That's his cabinet. And he has a very, very stormy 3 years as President of the United States. He went there without an agenda. Because presidents don't make laws. They're the chief executive. They sign legislation into law. And that's what Tyler believed, that that was his job. That was his purpose. Congress would pass laws, and he would sign them or not. And if he did sign them, then he would see as the executive that they were carried out. He'd actually enforce them if they could come up with something he could sign. So it was a stormy, stormy 3 years of war between John Tyler and his Congress. Only one of the former cabinet members stayed, Daniel Webster, which is another very interesting story that we don't have time to examine, but very, very interesting. The fact that Clay was a heavy drinker, a womanizer, a gambler, those things didn't give him any purchase at all with President Tyler. Well, the first thing they did was pass tariffs, protective tariffs to help the New England businesses raise money to protect them and to build bridges and roads in Kentucky, etc. And he became known as the veto president. Bobby Franklin, I am certain, would have really liked John Tyler. You know, Bobby Franklin was called Dr. No. Well, that's exactly the way John Tyler was. In fact, when a flu epidemic came, they called it the Tyler grip. His enemies were on every corner. A mob stormed the White House, throwing stones at the windows, burning the president in effigy, calling for his assassination. There were just all, the Whigs were able to whip up the crowds against John Tyler over and over again. Letitia died in the White House in 1842. And it's interesting, she is buried, and he is buried as well, in Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond. And his second wife that he goes on to marry, and that's a great story which I don't have time to tell, unfortunately. That's a wonderful tale. When his second wife found out that he had planned for both wives to be married, buried in the same plot with him last, she changed things around. She was not going to be buried in the same grave with his first wife. Anyway, there are lots of curious tales. But while in office, he was able to achieve the Webster-Ashburton Treaty with Great Britain, settling boundary lines. He settled the northern boundary, became fixed with Canada. He protected the independence of Hawaii from France and England. And this is interesting because Grover Cleveland is going to save Hawaii too from his political opponents who are trying to overthrow the Christian monarch of Hawaii in his day. An interesting connection between Tyler and Cleveland. I don't know how many have ever noticed that, but they both had to do with Hawaii, which is interesting. He signed the first treaty with China, and he brought about the annexation and statehood of Texas, which was his greatest triumph of all, since all of New England and all the Whigs were arrayed against Texas statehood. He outmaneuvered Clay time and time again. Tyler in Texas was actually the Democratic battle cry, and eventually they they nominated James K. Polk, and Tyler was going to run for president on the Democratic ticket, but he withdrew in favor of Polk. He returned to Sherwood Forest, which is still there, and his grandson lives in today. His grandson, Harrison Tyler, lives at Sherwood Forest. And while his presidency was marked by a few foreign policy triumphs, there were no domestic changes or domestic policy changes. And let me just mention this in closing about John Tyler. When Virginia seceded from the Union, John Tyler was elected to the Confederate Congress. But before that, he went on a peace mission to Abraham Lincoln to try and work things out after Lincoln was elected, to try and work things out to prevent the two sections from going to war. And Lincoln would not meet with him. He was 70 years old, and the president of that conference, although he was in ill health, he wanted to try and save the Union. As it turned out, the Union wasn't saved, and he went on to be a congressman in the Confederate Congress in Richmond, and while holding that office, he died. And it was the largest funeral ever held in Richmond, and perhaps in all the Confederacy, as he was taken and buried at Hollywood Cemetery. But a man greatly, greatly beloved by Virginia and by many others who admired his integrity and the solid constitutional stance that he took in Congress. So he's by most modern measures, an unsuccessful and forgettable president. The reality is he was really the opposite. He was extremely successful. He didn't sign many things into law at all. And he stood by the Constitution. And he retained his honor and all of his relations. And he communicated those things to his children, of which there were quite many to communicate to. And he died the only president not a citizen of the United States when he died. He was a citizen of the Confederacy. Well, the other president that I want to tell you about, that's one of my favorites and I think deserves attention and greatness, is Stephen Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland's terms in office are going to be in the 1880s and 1890s. He also is going to have a unique place in the American presidential history. He is going to serve two terms, but not consecutively. He serves 84 to 88, and then loses, and then serves 92. Is it 1892 to 1896, or is it 90 to 94? Anyway, two non-consecutive terms with a Republican stuck in between. He also is the only Democrat elected to the presidency between James Buchanan and Woodrow Wilson. So he broke the untrammeled string of corrupt Republicans that followed in the train of Abraham Lincoln. He was born in 1837 in Caldwell, New Jersey. And he was the fifth of nine children of a pastor, a Presbyterian pastor. His father, Richard, had attended Yale and Princeton. He was a man who served in the National Bible Society. He was secretary. He held several national positions of witness, but he also served as a pastor of the Presbyterian Church in those days, having trained under the Hodges, under Charles Hodge and Archibald Alexander first at Princeton, and living in New Jersey as well. But one of his biographers says this, that Grover Cleveland that his father, Richard Cleveland, reared his family on the Bible and the Westminster Confession of Faith. This may be the only president that knew the catechism, knew the Westminster Catechism. He certainly knew the Confession of Faith, and he certainly knew the Scriptures,
for he did quote them on a number of occasions.
He was known as a diligent and solid student. He was fun-loving. He had a very strong constitution, and he had an overbearing sense of responsibility and accountability. Now, there's something to build into a son, a strong sense of accountability and sensibleness and responsibility. And that was Grover Cleveland. And that was built into his character at an early age. And it served him well, because that's what he became known as an adult. A man who understood responsibility and accountability. Things that he would need on many, many occasions throughout his life. And you see the hand of providence quite a bit in both of these presidents. And in a very good sense.
Anyway, Grover Cleveland really had no real close friends growing up.
And his father took different churches. His father was called to a pastorate in New York. And he ended up at his last church at a town called Holland Patent in western New York. His father died when Grover Cleveland was 16 years old. And he then took care of, he was going to school. He dropped out to take care of the home, to take care of his mother and his sisters. Like I said, he's a man who understood responsibility and accountability. When his father died, he was the oldest son, and he took over.
When he turned 18, he went to work with his brother,
who worked for the State Institute for the Blind in New York City. And there, Grover Cleveland, just in that year with his brother, he met one of the, I don't know if she was a student or a teacher there, but her name was Fanny Crosby, the great hymn writer. And they became fast friends, and they corresponded the rest of their lives. Grover Cleveland and Fanny Crosby were buddies.
Probably not many people know that.
She's the one who wrote, "To God be the glory and blessed assurance, all the way my Savior leads me." Favorite kind of old-timey hymns from the 1880s. But Grover Cleveland was a good friend of hers. Just in that year that he worked with his brother with the blind. This is one of those little incidents in life that God providentially brings us to once in a while. And this close friendship, this firm friendship occurred there. Well, he decided to go to Cleveland, Ohio. Now, why Grover Cleveland wanted to go to Cleveland, Ohio is uncertain. It is definitely not named after him. But on his way there, after working with his brother for a year, he stopped in Buffalo, New York to visit his uncle, and he never left.
His uncle persuaded him to stay, to get a job, and as his most recent biographer, Mr. Pafford,
Pafford's biography is out on the table and is for sale. John Tyler doesn't really have a recent biography that I can recommend, but Grover Cleveland does, and it was published this past year, and it's very good. If you really want a short, a succinct, but very powerful biography of a man I consider a great man and a great president, that's one to get. If you like to read biographies, it really looks into the life and character of Grover Cleveland in a fairly short book.
Well, he visited with his uncle and made what
his new biographer, Pafford, called a providential decision. And his uncle found him employment with a law firm, Rogers, Bone, and Rogers. And he read law there from 1859 to 1862 and was licensed as an attorney. He was a Democrat in his politics. He did not serve in the War Between the States. He hired a substitute, which is going to come back to bite him when he runs for office. He's also going to do some other things that anger the Grand Army of the Republic in the post-war era. But he reads law, is appointed district attorney for Erie County, which is Buffalo, and he served there for 3 years. And he was described as a man of integrity, hard work, a mastery of cases, a good arguer, and a central member of the Democratic Party. He believed that the abolitionists were, in his words, ridiculous and would have no contacts with that wing of the Republican Party. He was anti-slavery, and he did support the war. He was what was called a war Democrat. But the thing that brought Grover Cleveland into prominence was his election as sheriff. The Erie County Sheriff Department was notoriously corrupt. It was known for its malfeasance, for its backroom dealing. And Grover Cleveland was told by his friends, why don't you run for sheriff and clean the place up? And he did, and he was elected. He already had a reputation as an honest lawyer, which made him stand out all the more. And so he ran for sheriff, was elected, and he found out very quickly on that there were men there in the jail, in Erie County Jail or Buffalo Jail, that had committed capital crimes, murderers, and that they were sentenced to death. And he also found out that it was the sheriff's responsibility to execute them. Now, all previous sheriffs had delegated that out to deputies and to others, and sometimes they made it spectacles. They'd build the gallows out where everybody could come and, you know, buy some lemonade and have a sandwich and watch people hang. And he was the new sheriff in town, and the law said that the sheriff was responsible for their execution. He was the chief law officer. So he had a gallows built. Everybody got excited. And then he had a wall built around the gallows so nobody could watch. And then on the appointed days, they marched out the two criminals. And he went up on the platform with them, said whatever the sheriff was required to say, put the nooses around their necks, pulled the lever, and hanged the two murderers. Well, word went around Buffalo instantly that this new sheriff is not going to be the typical corrupt sheriff that we've known before. Big Steve is serious about his job, and he follows the rules. He's responsible. He's accountable. Where did that come from? Well, that's the way he's going to be throughout his life.
So then, from there, he continues in Buffalo as an attorney
after he was sheriff for a goodly number of years, 20 years or so.
He mingled very little in general society.
He didn't care to travel anywhere.
He was single-minded in his legal work.
He spent much time in visits to his family home at Holland Patent.
He was devoted to a few good friends, but he was really devoted to his mother and sisters. He took care of them. So he did not marry at this point. And eventually he is going to marry in the White House, I think. I think he's going to be the second one after John Tyler. Actually doesn't get married in the White House. He has the first child born in the White House. In any case, in 1881, Cleveland, by that time, the head of the firm of Cleveland, Bissell, and Sicard, was asked by the New York Central Railroad to become its chief counsel in western New York. Now, in those days, the railroads were among the most powerful industrial interests in the United States. Notorious for corruption, notorious for payola to the politicians, and all of that. And they had huge staffs of legal counsels, and he was asked to join the Central, New York Central. His refusal was more important than anyone realized. If he had accepted that position, he would have spent the rest of his life as a lawyer for the New York Central Railroad. The pay was huge.
The perks were great, and he wasn't interested. He would never have become president had he
chosen that course. Providence once again
had steered him away from what would have become a very different life, and one that for which we would never hear of him again. He had a meteoric rise. For that same year that he turned down that job, he was asked by the Republican Party, or by the Democratic Party, to run for mayor of Buffalo, 1881. He ran. He was elected. He had a meteoric rise.
Less than 2 years later, he was elected governor of New York. He was, when he became the mayor, he stood against
the corrupt government of what was a bipartisan political ring in Buffalo. So he had to go against both parties, both the Democrat and Republican Party. And this was only a $2,500 a year office. And so the mayor typically had all kinds of deals going on to supplement his income. But Grover Cleveland was single, and he saved his money, and he could live on $2,500 without corrupt bargains. And so that's what he did. And there were no deals going on while he was the mayor. As one historian has said, his blunt honesty and energy particularly distinguished himself by the veto of numerous bad bills. His exposure of a scheme to rob the city of more than $100,000 on a street cleaning contract, and his insistence upon building a new sewage system without politics or graft, which was absolutely unheard of, made him not just popular in Buffalo, but popular among reformist Democrats all across New York. Now, in New York State, in New York City, and then extended out to New York State, the Democratic Party, at the core of the Democratic Party was what was called Tammany Hall in New York City. And it was corrupt political bosses, big city bosses. And they had their tentacles in every area of the state, and they controlled the Democratic Party. But because of the amount of corruption that was everywhere in New York, and of course they've eradicated that finally, and there's none today. But because there was so much corruption in the Democratic Party in New York, a huge reformist backlash took place, and a lot of Republicans bolted their party as well. And the reformers wanted Big Steve to be governor, and he had to go against Tammany Hall to do it, his own party, which he did. And surprise, surprise, he offended Jay Gould, and he offended Chester Arthur, the corrupt commissioner from New York City, and he beat them all at their own game, beat Tammany Hall.
He became governor.
He exposed all kinds of schemes on the state level. He offended all of the big political bosses of the state, and the reformers loved him, even the Republicans. And this breach between Cleveland and Tammany Hall eventually is going to be patched over a little bit. They're going to come toward him.
He never comes toward them. Well, he's mayor in 1881, he's governor in 1882, and he's president of the United States in 1884. Theodore Roosevelt said, "I rose like a rocket." He didn't rise as fast as Grover Cleveland did. Grover Cleveland rose like a rocket faster than even one of his successors bragged.
Well, the head of the Democratic Party, the main candidate for 1884, was Samuel Tilden. And he had suffered a stroke. And there was a great deal of enthusiasm in the West and in the South for Grover Cleveland, his reputation, a man of his stature. Think Chris Christie. That's what big Grover Cleveland was. He was a big man, except he was a man of integrity. He was a man of honesty. He was a man of principle. And he was a strict constitutionalist. That's not a comment on the governor of New Jersey. I don't know enough about him to comment on him other than his size. But Grover Cleveland had impressed people far and wide, not just in New York State. Men loved him for the enemies that he made. He drew lots of voters because of who didn't like him. All the corrupt politicians didn't like him,
in his party and the other. And in this election, the famous mugwumps carried him over the finish line. The mugwumps were Republicans. And they had so much corruption in their party that they bolted and they voted for Big Steve, who had gotten the Democratic nomination over the protests of Tammany Hall and other New York insiders. He was elected with 219 electoral votes. He defeated a very powerful senator from Maine. His name was James G. Blaine, continental liar from the state of Maine, as the slogan of the Democrats went. Cleveland's principal labors and worries during the first 10 months in the White House related to the filling of federal offices. More than 100,000 places were subject to the decisions of himself or his immediate subordinates. Now, most of those 100,000 jobs were post office jobs. But who wanted them? Every Tom, Dick, and Harry Democrat in New York wanted them. And Cleveland wouldn't appoint people that he didn't know, didn't like, or knew they were corrupt. Well, that was a problem, because all his presidents that preceded him had done that, but not him. He wanted the right man in the right place, and he was such a terrible person that if there was a Republican holding one of those bureaucratic jobs and the guy did a good job, he left him there or reappointed him. Oh, that was popular. And as president, he did all kinds of really neat, unpopular things. One of the things he decreed, and he had to back off of this because of the firestorm that it created, but he ordered the northern states to return the captured Confederate battle flags to the South. Now, that was popular in Georgia because they were missing a few. And the uproar from the Grand Army of the Republic, the GAR, who anointed presidents, they are the ones who determined who got elected, were the old soldiers. They were a very powerful political faction in both parties, especially the Republican Party. And they went berserk. So he had to withdraw his presidential order. He was trying to bring about harmony among the sections. He was trying to tamp down all the ill feelings that had been engendered by Reconstruction. Not that much earlier, 15 years earlier, 12 years earlier. He's trying to reunite the country, and he thought this would be a good gesture on the part of the northern states. Little did he realize how much those battle flags meant to them. And that's worthy of an interesting discussion. But the fact that he also he made reforms in handling naval contracts, which there was a great deal of corruption in the military, western lands, and the rights of Indians. Oh, he offended a lot of people by standing by treaties and things like that, things that aren't important to most politicians, and the management of the Treasury. They tried to get him on the Tenure in Office Act, which had been passed by Congress under Andrew Jackson. That is, he got rid of corrupt people in the bureaucracy. And when Andrew Johnson had done that, Congress, the radical Republican Congress, had passed a law called the Tenure in Office Act, which said the president couldn't fire anybody who had been put in office by the Senate. The Senate has to ratify appointments. So if the Senate's ratified an appointment, you can't fire them. That was struck down as unconstitutional. So they repassed it and modified it a little bit, and they tried to get Grover Cleveland on it because he put honest people in office, and they went after him for it. He vetoed scores of special or private pension bills
the Grand Army of the Republic, the Union veterans, many of them put in bogus applications for military pensions. The corruption in the VA system was horrendous. And he would deny these ones. He had a special commission just investigated these applications for government money from the soldiers. And he'd find out that they were bogus, so he'd veto them. Well, that outraged the GAR, because they've been throwing buckets of money at them for votes for years. And he vetoed that. Boy, he kicked over a hornet's nest on that one. And he also supported low tariffs, and he wouldn't sign any bill that had a high tariff, which he saw as unconstitutional.
He married a Miss Frances Folsom in his first term in office, 5-day honeymoon, and of course the press hounded him. They tried to spy on him and his bride, and that made him angry. And angry Grover Cleveland was not a good thing for the people at the other end of his wrath.
I need to hurry past his first term in office, but it was modestly successful, but not a lot of laws were passed, and a lot of vetoes were made, and the Constitution was upheld, and integrity was brought back to the presidency.
However, in the year 1888, it was evident the tariff question would dominate all political discussion, and in the end, the Republican Party was able to put up another war veteran, waving the bloody shirt, Benjamin Harrison was his name. And Cleveland felt that the dignity of his office required him to refrain from stumping any part of the country.
So he didn't run out and campaign around the country. He just thought the office of president was such an honor and such a dignified thing that he didn't need to be going on trains and horses and carriages and haranguing the democracy out there. But Harrison did, and in the end, he succeeded. It was a poorly managed campaign by Cleveland's managers, and he lost the election. Well, 4 years, corrupt politics, business as usual, and as the Clevelands were leaving the White House, his wife Frances turned to the butlers and the maids and said, "Don't touch anything, we'll be back in 4 years." And sure enough, they were. The only time in American history when that happened.
Well, he got back into politics in 1891, and in 1892 he was elected president one more time. And during his second term in office, there was an economic collapse. In fact, they call it, it was a huge economic, it wasn't just a downturn. It was like 1929, and a lot of people lost work, all kinds of reasons for it, none of them related to government policy. But whoever's in office when there's a big economic problem, an economic collapse, the president gets all the credit for it, or I should say all the blame for it, and he did. But he also was a man who believed in the gold standard. And economically, he opposed the part of his Democratic Party that wanted the free coinage of silver. Excuse me, I don't have time to go into what that means or how that worked, but he wanted the gold standard. He saw that as the best means of having a solid economy. But rising through the Democratic ranks was William Jennings Bryan, the prairie populist, who had all the farm interests behind him because he preached the free coinage of silver, that is, inflating the currency, making it easy for farmers to get loans, to borrow money, and to spread the currency thinner. And Cleveland opposed it. And Bryan, remember, preached his famous the Cross of Gold speech, which made him
made him so famous. And the Democratic Party slipped out of the hands of honest Grover Cleveland and into the hands of William
Jennings Bryan, who then is going to be the Democratic candidate for the next three elections or four,
the leader of the Democratic Party,
and Cleveland is going to pass out of the presidency in all politics in 1896.
While he was president in his second term,
I'll just add this in closing. Well, it's two things I want to say. One is he got a cancerous tumor on his jaw, and they took him on a ship.
Because the press followed them everywhere and bothered him, he had to secretly have this operation on his jaw. It was a very delicate and dangerous operation, and it took place on a boat. I think I don't remember if it was Long Island Sound or the Potomac River, but he was secreted out of the White House and snuck away to this boat, and he was taken out on the water, and there he was operated on. There's an entire book that came out last year or the year before just on this incident in American history. It's a very interesting and significant event, and he recovered from it. The surgery was successful, and nobody ever found out about it in his own time there, at least publicly. Well, having left the presidency, he retired to Princeton.
He liked Princeton. He liked the university atmosphere. They, of course, it was a Presbyterian university and seminary, and he was comfortable there. And so he lived out the rest of his life, not just rocking on his front porch, but he also taught courses and met with people. And he never wrote an autobiography. He was too modest for that. He really was a modest man and enjoyed the life of his children. His daughter that was born in the White House, by the way, was named Ruth. And they named the candy bar Baby Ruth after her. The Baby Ruth candy bar was invented during the time of Cleveland's second tenure in the White House. I even considered going out and buying a couple boxes of Baby Ruths and having them up here for you, but I forgot about it because I remembered it. I thought about it at 3:00 in the morning this morning. But Grover Cleveland died in Princeton, and he was quietly buried in the cemetery there with many, many people attending. It was an enormous funeral. But if you go to the Princeton Cemetery today, you'll see a modest marker, and it says Grover Cleveland, and that's all. There's nothing else on the marker. He was a modest man who wanted to be buried modestly. There's nothing on there about him being president of the United States or sheriff of Buffalo, New York, or anything else. He was just Grover Cleveland. He was just old Grover. And a man who passes into history as an average to mediocre president who didn't accomplish very much. He saved Hawaii for the Christian monarchy there. I mentioned it earlier. He had a number of accomplishments in his term that we don't have time to go into. But what characterized his term as president was the same thing that characterized John Tyler in certain ways, and that was his fidelity to a standard. The standard for him politically was the Constitution. But he was also a man of personal character and honor and courage and loyalty. He's the kind of man whose life you study and say, I hope my son turns out like that. That's what I want my son to be. In the case of Grover Cleveland, he was raised on the Bible and the catechism in the pastor's house. In the case of John Tyler, he was raised in the house of a man whose roommate was Thomas Jefferson and whose best friend was Patrick Henry. These were men whom Providence had destined for the presidency of the United States, and I would argue made them great.